very much. Hello, everybody. I should make it clear that I actually act for both sides, not just the defence, and only act for the defence these days if I'm paid an awful lot of money. Since the assets are frequently frozen on my car-paid lawyers, I'm mainly prosecuting these days. And in fact, as I drew into Manchester Station just this morning, I noticed that Alstom, an engineering company of a major worldwide nature, have various sheds actually next to the station. And brought to my mind what I was doing last night. I came out of a serious fraud office because we're involved in a prosecution of that company for bribery and corruption, which is ongoing at the moment. But as I left the serious fraud office and went to the underground station, I picked up the Evening Standard and saw on the front page a client of mine who I'd been in Wandsworth Prison seeing a couple of weeks before. So it was all, yesterday was all confiscation. And I think, interestingly, those two examples do bring into sharp focus some real issues that we have in confiscation in this country at the moment. If you take Mr. Hickman, who found himself on the front page of the Evening Standard, there were several years ago I represented him at a confiscation hearing in Southwark Crown Court. He had been selling Viagra illegally without a licence from various companies all over the world, and had actually, on any of you, made millions of pounds out of this. One could see from bank accounts that he'd received no less than £12 million and didn't really have an explanation as to where he'd gone. So the judge, Deborah, who I was at college with, duly made the order for £12 million confiscation, hidden assets. Mr. Hickman then served his sentence, served the whole sentence, so he didn't have any license period left, and then shoved off eventually to Marbella, where he was recently found living with three very large and vicious black Alsatians, which is, I think, rather curious, actually. But apparently he was also leading the high life in various Marbella nightclubs, but going back to the highly secure villa with the three black Alsatians. But the point is that he hasn't paid a penny of that order, apart from a fraction of £200,000 or so that was found in assets in this country. And, of course, he swears blind, he hasn't got anything at all. And I think that case is just so poignant, really, for the main problem we've got in confiscation in the United Kingdom at the moment. Because it's true that if you look at the graph, all orders of 1,000 are paid, or most of them are. It's only the orders over a million, I think, or half a million, where you find that 10% or 5% are paid. So it's, and those are the sort of cases I seem to get involved in. I do think there's a real problem at the moment in how the courts approach this. Because, in fact, as I said to the judge at the time, rather boldly, my junior kept tugging at me, I was saying, look, he's probably got 4 million. Make an order for 4 million. Don't make an order for 12 million because he won't get it. And the judge wasn't very impressed with that argument and went on to make the full order. But there's no doubt that someone like Hickman doesn't have all that money. It's almost certainly the case that he's likely to have a few million. I don't know, I'm just completely guessing. And I think we've sort of lost touch with reality in the court system, frankly. And it's no one's fault. It's a sort of juggernaut of enthusiasm. Let's hit the criminals. Keep hitting the criminals. And recently, as we'll see in a moment in the Ahmed case, and sort of the Ware case, and other cases such as Sale, we'll touch on it very briefly, the courts have now really tried to row back the other way. And even in a case called McIntosh, they looked at hidden assets and said, well, look, it's not all or nothing. If you disbelieve Mr. Hickman's of this world, you don't just make the order. But in practice, when someone like Mr. Hickman turns up and the judge thinks he's dishonest, and there's all sorts of evidence that £12 million has actually passed through his hand, it's very difficult to get persuaded court that they should make any other order, because the court is really being required to pluck a figure out of the air. So I think that is a major problem in the system still, and the way I think, being practical about it, the best way to deal with it, I try and deal with it, when I prosecute it, is to take a sensible approach, which is what we heard earlier from, was Adrian, from the CPS. Because actually, prosecutors have to have a responsible eye to what we're doing, I think. And it's not a good idea just to chuck the kitchen sink at people, which you can easily do. And so what I would say is, it's very sensible, but particularly now, for prosecutors to be sensible about the sort of orders they're seeking. And there are cases where the defendant is taking the mick, plainly, because he's had millions and it's not there anymore. And I suppose it's probably fair game in a case like that that he should be ordered to pay £12 million because he hasn't assisted the court, he's lying, he's had a lot of money. I don't have so much of a problem with those cases when you know that a defendant has had money. But there are all sorts of other cases, particularly tax cases and other benefit cases, when you don't really know he's haven't got a clue how much he's had, as we'll see with the Ahmed. So those two cases seem to really, because I'm obviously at the coalface of this some of the time at least, those two cases sort of brought into sharp focus for me the sort of problems we've got. This particular slide is all about the famous, what I call the MTIC story, the missing trade intra-community frauds, VAT frauds, that of course cost the country at least £15 billion before the government got a grip on it by 2006 by refusing to pay any exporters' reclaims. And it was quite an interesting fraud because it sort of seemed to kick off in the Midlands in Birmingham. The early MTICers were retired gas fitters who seemed to think this was a good idea. It then seemed to end up in Stoke for some reason. I think I do know the reason. And I've even got one client who's actually living in Dubai, but from Stoke. And in fact, I was in one case in the tax tribunal for the HMRC. It was a civil case. Well, we had this laminated card drawn up, a huge card, which showed where all the directors of all the worldwide companies lived who were involved in this worldwide trade. And these were companies in the British Virgin Islands, in Liberia, all over the world. And they all lived in Stoke, in two streets. So this MTIC business went on for an awful long time. In fact, it's still going on, because what happened was, of course, the government, with great respect, were too slow in dealing with it. It took them about 6 years to do what they did in the summer of 2006, which was to stop all the exporters getting their VAT automatically back, because we're talking here about carousel fraud, you appreciate, goods imported from Ireland, VAT-free, sold down a chain of companies, exported back to the same company in Ireland. The exporter reclaims VAT, and there's a missing trader at the point of import. That's the fraud we're talking about. And so the early MTICs were just, you know, tiny little circles. The circles got bigger and bigger and bigger with more and more companies involved in the chains to disguise the tax loss. You then had these this contra-trading and double contra-trading, which was disguising the tax loss across a sort of cross. So the tax loss you couldn't see going back and round in a circle. The tax loss was disguised by being off shooting somewhere else. So the frauds got cleverer and cleverer. But all that led to these appeals in the tribunal by these exporters who said, look, I'm entitled to my tax back. And there are hundreds of those still in the tribunals. I mean, I just did one recently. I do a few a year. Then we had these criminal prosecutions for VAT fraud, devout being the case, crime taking place in 2002, I think it was in Birmingham, finally ending up in the Supreme Court in June of this year. So that's, what, 12 years later from crime to Supreme Court. It's true that the trial didn't take place, I don't think, until 2007. You've still got a sort of, you know, you've still got these, as someone mentioned earlier, it's true that one of the problems we have with confiscation, it's another thing that needs to be reformed, is it just takes too long, and there needs to be a simpler way of dealing with it, and that would help everybody. But so you have your criminal prosecutions, and there are about 40 defendants in Northampton Crown Court, and about 45 at Southwark. These are all the MTICers. And in fact, I was acting for quite a few of them, but sometimes on both sides, which was a bit uncomfortable. But it meant that I had a pretty good view of the case. In fact, when I got to the Supreme Court, acting for the Crown Prosecution Service, in the Ahmed case, I had actually acted for someone in the same case 7 years before in Northampton Crown Court. But it was of course, perfectly proper for me to do so, and I did it. Here we just have, very quickly for you, the issue in the first tier tax tribunal. It's called the Kittel test. It's a civil procedure that that's engaged in, where the exporter who's saying, give me my VAT back, He doesn't get it back. He loses his right to that VAT if he knew or ought to have known that the transaction he entered into was connected to a tax loss. So there's a nice simple test in the tax tribunal now, and they're very fact-specific, these cases, and that's where a lot of this tax fraud ended up being litigated. With your flagship prosecution that I've described. And here I just wanted to point out to you the government, and the, no disrespect, but the prosecutors are often slightly behind the fraudsters, who are always one step ahead. Once they had contra trading up and running, HMRC realised that's going on, and they move in there. But then there's double contra trading, and even something called triple contra trading. So, you had your high success rates in the criminal cases, but not very many of them. Hundreds of cases in the civil cases in the tax tribunal. But what I really wanted to talk to you about today, or to tell you about, because it's quite recent, is the Ahmad case, because the Supreme Court in June of this year gave judgment. The Ahmeds, Shakil and Syed Ahmed, running a company in Birmingham, the facts of the case arose out of 32 transactions that they undertook in respect of CPUs, that's computer processing units, in April of 2002. And what they were doing, they were part of this circle I've just described to you, so they were not the importer, who was the missing trader, they were the first line buffer, so they were company one up the line. They then, in fact, sold the goods to Harringtons, who were an exporter, who were never prosecuted, but who had their tax denied, and they ended up in the tax tribunal. So, what happened to the Ahmeds, and what's it got to do with confiscation? As you appreciate, the question the court had to grapple with in the Crown Court, what had the Ahmeds obtained as a result of or in connection with their criminal conduct? Mr. Justice Flo found that each had obtained the money going through the bank accounts, which had caused those 32 trades to take place. So in other words, the gross figures. He thus found that figure was £72 million going through bank accounts, which was the gross monies just transferred. The profit on the trades was tiny. One of the features of the trade was each of the buffers always has the same profit margin, 1.1%. So Mr. Justice Flo didn't take the tax loss, which was £12.6 million, the VAT loss. He took the gross turnover, and then each Ahmad was ordered to pay £72 million, uplifted to inflation, came to £92 million each. That's quite a lot of money. Now, it's true that the Ahmeds have, in fact, been doing VAT fraud for years before that date, and actually they've been doing it afterwards, interestingly. They just carried on doing it until 2006, which is rather strange that we've permitted that. So they do have lots of money, the Ahmeds, no doubt about that. I've even been out in Dubai, actually, and someone said to me, oh, those are the Ahmed Towers. Now, if anyone's been to Dubai, there are hundreds of thousands of towers. It's just towers. I think I have a fairly good authority that the Ahmeds, it's undoubtedly the case, that the Ahmeds shunted millions, probably 20 million, actually, at least, to Dubai, Jersey, and Switzerland. And that's why Mr. Justice Flo described them as deeply mendacious in his judgment, especially about their assets, which they plainly were. So, £184 million, tax loss of 12. Well, that does seem a little bit disproportionate, doesn't it? And it got in front of Lord Justice Hooper in the Court of Appeal, sadly now retired, fantastic judge. He said something's gone wrong here. It was his instinct for it, quite right too, I suppose. And the issue in the Court of Appeal, though, was what have the Ahmeds obtained? Have they obtained the money going through the bank account, the 72 million? Answer, no, they've obtained the tax loss. A perfectly sensible result. The Crown, not then represented by me, decided to appeal. Which you might think was not a very sensible thing to do, to try and put back on the books orders for £184 million, which you were never going to get. It just increases the £1.2 billion we haven't got and aren't going to get. And also, I think, frankly, it's not right, would be my judgment on it. But the prosecution get leave to appeal, and then they withdraw the appeal on certain advice from certain new leading counsel. But as they withdraw the appeal, the Ahmeds come in and say, right, we want a cross appeal now on a new point, the old chestnut of joint benefit, which you will know and love. So the committee of the Supreme Court, Amin Ar, and say, well, we'll give you leave on it. So that's why it ended up in the Supreme Court, not because the defence ever sort of wanted to, or they failed on their original grounds, but because the prosecution tried, withdrew, and then they came in through a side door. But it's probably quite a good thing it happened, because the Ahmad Supreme Court judgment is quite sensible. It takes the sort of Weyer principles, you know, the proportionality forward quite well. And what they really said in the Supreme Court was, in a case where there's joint benefit, the court should, as it did before, applying sort of common sense rules, decide whether two or three criminals have jointly obtained something, applying common sense rules, not over legalistic rules. And then it's perfectly proper for the court to say that two Ahmeds jointly obtained the tax loss of £12 million. Fine. But then they also said that we're going to put in place a confiscation cap. And that's quite an interesting concept. And what Lord Justice Hughes said was, and just to quote him, when you have a joint benefit order, the order has to read, it should provide, it's not to be enforced to the extent that a sum has been recovered by way of satisfaction of another confiscation order made in relation to the same joint benefit. So that's quite a major change in the law. Cases such as Lambert and Walding, where you had two drug dealers, each ordered to pay £100,000, each had a house, that sort of case would now be decided differently. So that's what that said. I'm now running out of time. Just finally, this is in fact the last slide, that was quite a major change. Just briefly to tell you one of the interesting arguments about that case, the most interesting case referred to was one from 1725 called Everett and Williams, because in that case, two highwaymen who used to operate from what is now the Suicide Bridge, if any of you know it coming into London, just around the A1, had a very successful business, and they never got caught. But Williams refused to hand over to Everett his share of the stash. And so Everett sued him in the Chancery Division for a share of the proceeds of their crime. And the Lord Chancellor not only dispatched the case in very peremptory fashion in a short judgment, but he also locked the lawyers up for being so impertinent for bringing the claim in the first place. But that's, of course, relevant because we don't inquire into the dealings between criminals. Thus, the joint benefit is fine. Right, finally, these are just the latest cases. I'm just about to finish right now for you. I think the most important one is probably Sale. It's the only thing I'll talk about now. It's this issue of, in a bribery and corruption case, what is the benefit from the crime? Used to be thought it was the total value of the contract obtained through bribery. Answer, no, it's not, say the Court of Appeal. It is the profits from your deal plus your pecuniary advantage in the marketplace. Query, how do we value that? Thank you very much.